Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're Russia, then whatever has changed in the world, your ports still freeze and the northern European plains are still flat. So how you see your threats and opportunities, in many ways, these things haven't changed.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the acting editor of CapEx. Gisela Stuart is a rare figure in British politics, a Labour politician who campaigned wholeheartedly for Brexit. As an MP from 1997 to 2017, Gisela is perhaps best known for her role in the 2016 referendum, where she chaired the Vote Leave campaign and appeared in the TV debates. But her deep interest in constitutional and foreign affairs long predates that referendum. Gisela sat on the Foreign Affairs Select Committee for nearly a decade, was a founding signatory to the foreign policy think tank the Henry Jackson Society, and is now chair of Wilton Park, an executive agency of the Foreign Office dedicated to mediation and resolving international conflict. Our assistant editor, Frank Lawton, sat down with her to chat all things foreign affairs. He began by asking her whether Britain actually had a foreign policy.
Well, we are represented in a large number of international organisations where the UK takes a very significant role, whether it's a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, to the Commonwealth, to the World Bank, you name it, we are represented. But if you were to say, do we have a coherent strand by which we project our place in the world, and how we use our military, our international aid, and our consular diplomatic power, I would argue that we probably haven't had one since the last decade of the last century.
Why do you think that is?
The new Labour government, when it came in 97, if you look at the people who formed the first Blair government, you had a number of big individuals, you know, whether it was Robin Cook or George Robertson, Blair, Brown, who had thought about what a Labour government would look like, but also realised that part of the redefinition of the new Labour project was our role in the world. George Robertson came in as Defence Secretary, and if you talk to people in the MOD, they will say that that probably was the last truly comprehensive defence review. And it had some fundamentals underpinning it. You know, we're an island. What is the threat from the air? What is our appetite for expeditionary forces, which then determine the size of the army? But then we also made a really big decision that we would take international aid out of the Foreign Office, and we gave it a very specific target on spending. And that was only for poverty reduction. And what happened rather unexpectedly is that whilst people thought to begin with that would weaken our international aid presence in the face of a strong, overpowering Foreign Office, the reverse happened. Then, of course, we know Iraq happens. Foreign policy suddenly made by direct phone calls through number 10. And we've now got very weak institutions which don't interact, and that's something which we have to change.
So you were in Parliament when the decisions on Iraq and Afghanistan were made. What do you think the effect of those decisions has had on what we think of as the possibilities of our foreign policy? Has it made us move back, withdraw within to ourselves? Has it changed the way we see ourselves in the world?
I think we still haven't really faced up to the process of decision-making, and we have a parliament that, with every election, brings in another wave of MPs who probably are more familiar with a map of their constituency, which shows their potholes, than a map of the former Yugoslavia and what the finer points of the various constituents' parts and their needs are. And I understand that, because the need to get re-elected is the primary thing which drives MPs. But you see, what I find so curious is that we've forgotten that in the 90s it seemed as if everything was possible. The Berlin Wall falls. We think liberal democracies have prevailed. The end of the Soviet Union. We start intervening in a successful way in the Balkans. You know, we did so without a UN mandate. People have forgotten that.
Yeah.
We went to Sierra Leone. And that gives rise to Blair's great Chicago speech, which starts to introduce a concept of a duty to protect. And in that spirit of that we can actually prevent that intervention works, we suddenly have Iraq. And I still remember I voted for the intervention in Iraq on the basis of the first Iraq war, unfinished business, no armistice agreement, breaches of UN resolution after UN resolution. And the question should have been, why now? And that's where I think people, including the Prime Minister, sort of lost their bottle. Mm. And they started to go down the road of weapons of mass destruction. They started to talk about 45 minutes, which, quite frankly, was never clear to me just what precisely could be done in 45 minutes. And I remember asking the then Defense Secretary, Jeff Hoon, and he explained to me very carefully what the Sun newspaper would do to us. Which I didn't think had anything to do with the 45 minutes. And it was at that stage, with the lack of future preparation, that I think we started to lose our way. And why that matters today is that we have now, as in many other areas of politics, a very curious position where we kind of argue that intervention is bad when it comes to Iraq. Or even with hindsight now, Libya. But this very same people will tell you that Syria came about because we didn't intervene.
Mm.
And I remember going into the Syria debate where, again, we have to remind ourselves what happens. Parliament is in recess. It's about to come back on a Tuesday. The Prime Minister recalls Parliament following the what was then almost established chemical attack in Syria, and this assumption by the international community that a red line had been crossed. He recalls Parliament early the week before. So I went into the vote being usually fairly hawkish, thinking there must be a reason why we asked to come back four days early. There must be an explanation why some things needed to be done now, as, for example, would have been with Libya, the imminent attack on Benghazi. And David Cameron gave absolutely no reason, which, it persuaded me not to vote for intervention, even though I'd gone in wanting to support it. So Parliament, in a sense, has to make up its mind. It cannot go on being in a position that whatever was done with hindsight was wrong.
Mm. Well, do you think that there's maybe a need, you know, you're the chair of Wilton Park, an executive agency of the Foreign Office. Do you think that there's perhaps a need to change the structure of how we make foreign policy decisions? Because we have the Foreign Office, but we also have the Department for International Development, the Department for International Trade, perhaps the Ministry of Defence and the Ministry for Exiting the European Union, all of whom are involved with making foreign policy or are enacting versions of foreign policy. Do you think that that's a little perhaps confusing? Does that mean there's a lack of joined-up thinking? Or is that just a way of sort of dispersing responsibility and being more effective?
I mean, Wilton Park is an interesting organisation in the sense that as an executive agency of the Foreign Office, it is not the Foreign Office, but it is part of the Foreign Office. Mm. And it's not a think tank in the sense that it creates its own policies. It does so by using its power to convene.
Mm.
and the power to convene people who may normally not meet, or giving them the space to think long-term ahead on a national and international level, and increasingly we're doing it away from the UK and also do it abroad, is very effective, because it feeds into a policy stream, not just here but also abroad. And above all, it doesn't require anybody to try and take the credit for anything. You just give them the space to think, and you moderate the debates. And since leaving Parliament in 2017, I continued to be a director at the Henry Jackson Society, which we founded in 2005, which was to make the case for liberal democracies. I worked with the British Foreign Policy Forum. It's the very question of what do we need to do to have a foreign policy is the thing which exercises me. And I think there are two things. One is we do need a debate which makes it quite clear that foreign policy is actually a domestic issue. Mm. It is not something to say it's got nothing to do with us. And therefore, whether it's politicians in their constituencies, whether it's universities, whether it's the under-35s, we need to engage because it affects us all. In terms of Whitehall, my sense is there has been a recognition that to have the MOD with a target of 2% of GDP spending to fit in with the NATO commitment, to have DFID with a statutory target of 0.7, and the Foreign Office as an institution that has no protected budget, and I think at the last round got 0.09%, there's an imbalance there. And the people within Whitehall do realise that they need to work together more effectively. But I think over the last 10 years, we have seen a reduction in the number of those middle-ranking civil servants who these days would be in their early 40s, mid-40s, who are just ready for the next step of promotion to become key decision-makers. I think there's a real shortage of them. So there's almost an administrative capacity lacking to do what we want to do.
I mean, historically, the Foreign Office has always been fairly small as a department, but it seems, as you say, to be getting smaller, which seems odd at a time of the sort of resurgence of the need for foreign policy and defence policy in the wake of Brexit, which obviously is as much a foreign policy challenge as a domestic issue, or just a purely European issue. So why do you think, then, that the Foreign Office and the Ministry for Defence have been shrunk, or not at least been enlarged in the wake of, you know, the context that clearly requires them to be at the forefront of where Britain is going in the future?
Well, you know, as we speak today, it's the Supreme Court has just handed down a judgment which I think will send ruptures across the entire constitutional structures. And things will change, and part of the things which I think will change, that notion of taking international trade out of the Foreign Office, to take Department for Exiting EU out of the Foreign Office. There will be a kind of a realignment, because what I think will, in the years to come, drive our global Britain aim, you know, whatever global Britain means, I think will be three things. One is trade. Big driving force. The second one will be a greater focus of what we can actually achieve with the soft power, not in the traditional areas, but in the growing areas. And I sometimes say that the best way of understanding how things are changing is, you know, in my case, take one of your children's globes off the shelf and sort of tilt it and turn it around so that the North Pole comes closer into your centre of vision, and also the Indian subcontinent becomes more to the centre, because I think that's where a lot of the shifts have gone. And the third thing is, I think Jeremy Hunt in that sense was very interesting, that when he was Foreign Secretary, he took, of course, his commitment to global health with him to the Foreign Office, that there are issues such as health, which we have often seen as being purely domestic, will be seen as much greater players on a global scale.
What then should we mention global Britain and the possible outline for the future? What should global Britain mean? What does it mean? I mean, it obviously hasn't been defined particularly clearly at this point, but what, in your opinion, should it mean in the wake of the new emerging context of foreign affairs, foreign relations, America perhaps withdrawing, but us moving away from the European Union in terms of its political structures at least? Where does the future lie for Britain? Do you think we have to pivot one way or another, that we should be, as you say, developing other areas like global health concerns? What is the idea of global Britain? Because it's a big slogan that's been around since before the referendum, really. But we still don't seem to be necessarily any clearer on what it means.
You see, what strikes me is that two assumptions which we've had for a very long time are being challenged, and that feeds into what I think the definition of global Britain should be. First of all, we kind of got through a phase where we decided geopolitics doesn't matter. Mm. And if you go back and look at geopolitics in terms of the size, your population, your natural resources, your trade routes, I think we're coming back to being aware that this does matter. And I was reading something on China and Russia last night, and I hadn't realized that if you look at the population ratio, you've got 144 million Russians, if you exclude the Ukraine, but you've got 1.4 billion Chinese. This matters, you know. Mm. And they also made the case of that if you're Russia, then whatever has changed in the world, your ports still freeze, and the northern European plains are still flat. So how you see your threats and opportunities, in many ways, these things haven't changed. Now, some of those may change. And on top of that, we've assumed that liberal democracies will prevail. And if you have asked me what did I think was the one kind of key of what makes the United Kingdom the United Kingdom, it is its kind of commitment to the rule of law and pretty robust institutions. And that doesn't just mean you go out and you sort of think that just because Afghanistan has a ballot box and a piece of paper where you put a cross on, we've achieved democracy. Mm. But it's the adaptability of liberal democracies which, to my mind, produces economic prosperity. And I think that's where we still, both by geography and by long-standing instincts, can play a big role.
So we still should be promoting those things. So interventionism shouldn't be dead, but it might not mean military interventionism. It might mean democratic interventionism. It might mean through various initiatives. Is that what you're saying?
And a very grown-up debate as to what we can and cannot do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you think our defence spending, just to get sort of go back to that point, though, I mean, it's often the elephant in the room, it seems, when we talk about foreign policy, which is that our defence spending in as a proportion of GDP has gone down since 2014. And obviously, defence normally provides the ultimate backing for diplomacy. It's at least historically thought to do that. Do you think that we need to up our game on defence spending, particularly in the wake of a more perhaps recalcitrant United States?
Well, defence spending is kind of an interesting one. Some would argue that the minute our army falls below 80,000, we have kind of lost a comprehensive capacity. We have just withdrawn from Germany, and therefore I think may have given up a fairly pivotal role on mainland of Europe. I think it's a question of what we spend it on. And you're right to talk about America's attitude towards the North Atlantic Alliance. So I think our continued cooperation and working together with the French will continue, and it will continue to be very strong, because we both have got the capacity and a willingness to deploy. But it's going to be much more of a question of the things we do and the things we don't do. And that's where the challenge for the politicians is going to be very strong. I know it is really satisfying if you're an MP and it is either MOD question time or foreign policy question, and you go in there and the night before you've just read some unrest in the chat, and you get up and you say, has the minister realised the terrible threat to country X and F, and what is he going to do about it? Or, glad to say, increasingly, what is she going to do about it? And ministers will get up and say, well, I've phoned the embassy and I'm talking to... But there comes a point where we actually might have to say, you know what? We haven't got a diplomatic representation there. We have got a small embassy there which has got 5 members of staff who actually focus on trade. And I don't think there's anything we can do about it.
Do you think that... So to my mind, there does seem to be a tension between how we think about foreign policy. There's a lack of coherence in our foreign policy, as you've outlined. We recoil now from intervening, it seems. We underfund the Foreign Office and we have a minimal defence spend, but at the same time we have this absurd overestimate of what our capabilities might be, this sort of fantasy reality of what we can do on the world stage. How then do you prevent that fantasy, or at least pull back from it and draw out a map of reality, what we can do? How would you actually pass that down to MPs, to the general public? How do you sort of let people know what the sphere of capability might be? Therefore, that will change how we think about our role in the world, as opposed to just thinking, well, we're Britain, we can do whatever. We might be a middleweight power, as opposed to a great power, despite being, part of the G7, 8, G20, etc. There are, as you say, only a certain number of things we might be able to do in the current context of our spending.
It's always interesting when, in a well-working institution, when one part fails, if things work well, then another part becomes stronger. And curiously, the greater input and the more strategic thinking of the select committees and their chairs has been, to me, quite an eye-opener. And I think there's a real way forward, that the way the select committee chairs are chosen, the parliament votes for them for a term, they carry a greater authority to speak. It's cross-party, and particularly if I look at both defence and the foreign affairs committees, have come up with some very useful indicators and very good policy things. So, the foreign affairs committee looking at our relationship with China, I think was probably more outward-looking than a lot of things I've seen coming out of government. So I think that is the way forward, because if it is the MPs in the shapes of select committees who arrive at the conclusions that they need to be slightly more realistic, then, in a sense, the MPs have already bought into that. So it's an internal education process. But there is a curious... I'm struggling to find the right word without wishing to cause offence, but I'm wondering whether it is a myth or whether it is something so deep in the British psyche that I just fail to fully appreciate it. But whether it comes to the Blitz or whether it comes to Dunkirk or whether it comes to the last Olympics in London, there is this intrinsic belief that however we may to appear to lack administrative capacity, give us a deadline, put us into a corner, and we'll you know what, we will deliver. And I hope that that spirit is there in greater depth than I see it at the moment. Mm. Because, you know, I keep reminding myself of Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, about probably almost 2 years ago when this sort of disjunction of Brexit started to become apparent, said, you have to ask yourself how a country with a reputation for political stability, administrative capacity, and being one of the world's fifth largest economies could have got itself into such a mess. Mm. I think we're seeing something much more fundamental that's going on here.
Well, it's that talk of deadlines that inevitably does bring us back to Brexit. I mean, to try and again step back from the nitty-gritty of what Brexit is doing to our institutions or what we're doing to our institutions in the name of Brexit. Obviously, you were very involved in, you know, you ran the Vote Leave campaign, and very interested in foreign policy at that point. What was your response to the argument that Brexit was or would be an abnegation of our sort of historic role in terms of foreign policy, that we would be a balancing power within Europe to prevent any major continental power unifying and therefore gaining, you know, greater strength than we would want? It seems to me one of the ironies of Brexit is that having always been the brake on European integration while within Europe, we've pulled out of Europe and has actually ironically seemed to unify Europe and made the likelihood project of federalism stronger, perhaps. Do you think that argument is a correct argument, or is it just, I suppose, wishful thinking is the wrong term because you have to be a federalist to wish for it, but that's just a misreading of the situation.
But it's interesting that I agree with both parts of your statement, except that I don't accept the causal relationship. You are right. Historically, it has never been in the British Isles' interest to have one central power dominating the continent of Europe. And up until 73, there were two forms of how nation states in Europe related to each other. They either were part of the European Economic Community, which was a post-World War II construct to ensure that Germany and France would never go to war again.
Yep.
Let's just be absolutely clear about that. It was an economic tying in, the original six members, the Benelux countries, there was a logic to that. Italy, it's almost historic. But it was a project where we tried to replace ideology and the dark underbelly of nationalism by a system that was bureaucratically efficient and could deliver an economically better tomorrow.
Mm.
And for that, we took the excitement out of it, of ideologies. But hand in hand with that went that if the common market provided economic stability, then NATO would provide the military protection. When Britain joined in 1973, it went against its stated object because it actually became part of that nascent single power rather than being a counterbalance. And what's more, it deprived any small country in the rest of the European continent of a choice, because we left EFTA and that just left. And the logic of this you saw after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the 11 accession states, when they joined in 2004, for them there was no other option on the table. But now we've got new fault lines, and that is whether you are part of the single currency or not a part of the single currency. It's whether you're a debtor country or whether you're a beneficiary of that single currency. And it will be interesting whether in 50 years' time it will be seen as more remarkable that we decided to join in 73 rather than our decision to leave in 2016. I think it's the latter.
Do you think you'll see a two-speed Europe in that period, by the way? You're talking about the
UK. Yes.
You think you'll see 2 tiers of it?
Oh, inevitably, because the deeper integrational requirements of the single currency, you know, who is the sovereign in this? Who is the ultimate underwriter of the currency? It always was a reluctant Germany at a time when Germany had the financial capacity to be one. There was a political reluctance. Whereas if you look at the size of the structure and what's happening to the German economy, German political reluctance may also be now be combined with Germans' inability to deal with the size of the task. So we will have new tensions. And you see, when David Cameron called the referendum in 2016, I always ask myself, when I'm faced with what are really difficult decisions, and I get to the point where I think I know where I'm going, I then ask myself, okay, and what would need to happen for me not to do this? So I sat down and thought, what would have been the deal David Cameron would have had to come back from Brussels, which would have made me campaign to remain? And it would have been a permanent recognition enshrined in the architecture of the European Union that forever and ever you will have countries who are part of the single currency and countries who are not. Not an opt-out, not something that's temporary, but it's a different structure. And that I would have said, yep, okay, let's give that a try.
How then, in the development of this two-speed Europe, where there will be countries part of the single currency and countries that aren't, and that might, you know, change the federal balance, how do you think the UK will interact with that new Europe after Brexit? Do you think it will sort of drift or walk towards the sort of lower tier of the European project, the one that is a step removed from the central powers? Or do you think that by that point it's a whole new world, we can't, you know, it's too far away to discuss? But because that second tier of Europe sounds more like the sort of thing you were talking about.
I think for the UK there's going to be an additional challenge, because the divide is not just Euro, non-Euro. It's then Northern Euro, Southern Euro countries. The Northern Euro member states are the positive contributors, the Southern Euro aren't. And that tension plays itself out in different ways. And I think that's where the UK has to come back and think strategically. It needs to think about its own defence needs, which will make Scandinavia very important. You know, we've kind of forgotten, or we're not taking notice of that the Scandinavians are very conscious of their never easy relationship with Russia. You know, Sweden has reintroduced conscription. And in that context, Poland will be very important. In terms of trade, I think, you know, North Africa will in that sense be important. So it will be a change, and that's where Britain can only make strategic decisions if it's aware of its capabilities and its constraints.
Yeah. One thing that looms over this whole debate is the possibility, or at least to my mind, is the possibility of a Jeremy Corbyn government. Because to my mind, from his history as an activist, his history as a parliamentarian, the impact of a Jeremy Corbyn government on our foreign policy aims would be quite profound regarding his relationship with NATO, his relationship with America. Would you agree with that? And that if there was a Jeremy Corbyn government, there would be have to be a considerable reconsideration of that question of strategy, because his government would operate upon, it seems, fairly different lines to the past 50 years of British foreign policy. Or do you think, naturally, once he's in government, he'd be more likely just to sort of be ameliorated and brought into the standard system?
Given the events of the last 3 years, I have definitely given up any kind of predictions as to what people would do. The only thought that's kind of left with me is that it doesn't seem to me at the moment as if any party is likely to go into a general election and end up with a massive majority.
Mm.
You know, I came into Parliament in 97 when our chief whips thought it was a failure of the whipping system when our majority was less than 100. You know,
another era.
Easy to forget these things. And if you want to bring about fundamental changes, you do need significant majorities.
Yeah.
And the kind of dividing lines between some of those big foreign policy decisions don't necessarily fall along party lines.
Mm.
So I think you would have rather interesting debates. I think, of course, if you had another Scottish referendum, even just having a referendum, irrespective of what that outcome would be, the question of fast lane would come up again, because in the last referendum, the SNP got itself in a position where they kind of stuck with NATO and actually stuck with a nuclear deterrent rather than... So there would be some debates, but... And probably some very much needed debates. But whether any party would have a significant majority to bring about big changes, I would doubt.
The historic continuity of the Foreign Office might prevail.
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, Isla Stewart, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.